Hello, this is Nick Savvides. You're listening to the End Savvides podcast. This is a show where we talk about the art of collaboration, of working with others in pursuit of excellence. Our guest today is Bo Burlingham. He's the editor at large of Inc. magazine. He's also the visionary behind the Small Giants movement. It started as a book he wrote. Now it's a whole community. Recently, he wrote a kind of continuation of that book called Finish Big. You could even say Small Giants, Finish Big. Look at the word choice. Small, big. You see? You get it? All right. Let's not belabor that, but they're connected. Both books look at the values that go beyond the bottom line in making a great business or transitioning to the next step. This is a show where we're often talking to creative types. So why bring in someone with more of a business background? Well, business people and creative types need each other. In this interview, we talk about the PR problem that business has, why there's that negative association in our culture about business and what creative types can do to help alter that. And a creative person who doesn't have a business sense is not going to get very far. You want to make a music album that's going to get heard across the world, or you want to make something like, I don't know, The Lord of the Rings. Good luck trying to make that without any consideration for the business side. Later in the interview, we even talk about how to approach business people when trying to get a creative project funding. And while it might not seem like it initially, Bo's book, Finish Big, relates quite a bit to the business model of a creative person. While a business will grow and grow and make profit and then sell, for many creative types, actors, musicians, performers, whatever, they work for months or years not getting paid, refining their craft. And then when they get to the point of sale, when they're getting an agent, when they're signing a deal, that's when their career might start. So all the things that Bo talks about definitely relate to the things that creative people are facing right when they get to that next step. Those are several reasons you're going to want to stick around. All right? It's our conversation with Bo Burlingham coming up next.
This is the End Savvides podcast.
Hello, hello, hello. Bo Burlingham, welcome to the End Savvides podcast.
Well, it's good to be here, Nick.
By way of introduction, give us a quick sense of what your day-to-day activities are like being an editor for Inc. magazine.
Well, being an editor at large is actually a great position to have because nobody knows exactly what you're doing or where you are. And so I actually have a great deal of leeway. In fact, I just got back from France yesterday because my wife and I have a house there.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, we go there about three times a year for 3 or 4 weeks. So we just came back. What I do at Inc. is that, I do the column with Norm Brodsky called Street Smarts, and I also write features.
All right. Well, Bo, for those who don't know what it means to be a small giant, give us a quick sense of what that's about.
Well, in a nutshell, it's what the subtitle says, namely companies that choose to be great instead of big. Really, it's about companies that have resisted the temptation and the pressures to grow as fast as possible and get as big as possible as quickly as possible because they have other goals they consider more important, such as being great citizens of their community or having a really great place to work, or providing an extraordinary level of customer service. Wherever they are, they aspire to be the best in the world at what they do, but they view revenue growth and profit as a byproduct of doing these other things. It's not the goal itself. And it turns out that there are actually a huge number of these companies, not only in this country, but around the world. And I think that one of the things that Small Giants, the book, did was really to tell people that it was all right not to push yourself and push your company to grow as fast as possible, that and to sort of remind people that greatness and bigness are two totally separate things. And it's easy to lose sight of that. But when you sit down and you think about it, you know, obviously a great company is not necessarily a big company, and a big company is not necessarily a great company. And so it really, just by putting that out there, I think it forces people to ask themselves, okay, well, what does it really mean to have a great business? And, you know, different people will have different answers for that. But everybody, I think, benefits by asking themselves that question and then answering it in their own terms. It's pretty neat to see that Small Giants has developed a following all around the world. And it's always really thrilling when I see that somebody has read the book and gotten something positive out of it to the point where they really want to change the way that they do business. That's very gratifying, because after all, what's the point other than to be of some service to people?
Yeah. Well, Bo, before we go further, I have a pressing question I want to ask you.
Sure.
So I was reading up. It turns out Small Giants, the paperback, came out, it seems, 2007, and then the New York Giants went on to win the Super Bowl that season. Now that the Patriots have finally won, are you doing Small Patriots? And if so, what will that involve?
No.
No. Okay.
I am, however, a diehard Patriots fan.
Yes, I remember. You didn't share my enthusiasm when I was making reference to Small Giants in terms of 2011 Super Bowl victory.
Right. There have been a couple of heartbreaking Super Bowls, at least heartbreaking for Patriots fans. I'm sure they are very gratifying for New York Giants fans.
That's right. Well, three times a charm, right? You all finally pulled it off.
Yeah, right. What a Super Bowl that was, too.
All right, getting back to Small Giants, I found it really refreshing when I came across your book, because it does have that values-driven sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I noticed on your Small Giants community, you all had that campaign, the return on value, as
right.
opposed to return on investment.
Right.
It seems like that was such a refreshing counterbalance to a lot of the other rhetoric out there at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there were certainly others who were talking about ethics, but you all helped to make that more prominent in the discussion. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, this is something that's happening in the business world that goes beyond Small Giants. It's, I mean, there are a lot of other organizations out there that have embraced a lot of the values that the Small Giants embrace as well. And I do think that probably the most valuable service was to give a name to the phenomenon, you know, because we tend to talk about small companies and large companies. And in fact, there are millions and millions of small companies, and they're very different. You know, there's the mom and pop grocery store, and there are other sort of small companies out there. And I think that by just giving a name and saying, look, a Small Giant is a great company that is not necessarily the biggest in its industry, it doesn't aspire to be the biggest industry, but does aspire to be a great company. And I think just giving it a name helped people a lot.
Yeah, it was striking to me. I recently read Conscious Capitalism,
right,
the book from John Mackey. And I mean, in there, he's talking about how profit isn't the primary thing and that a business should be focused on love and serving others. And it seems to me that maybe a book like Small Giants helped make that more accessible and something that even business people would not shy away from, is saying, no, we don't want any of this touchy-feely stuff. We're gonna be number one. And
to give John Mackey his due, he believed this. I've known John for years, and he believed all of this stuff, including a lot of this stuff that I wrote about, for years and years and years. It's something that that are a set of beliefs that he holds dearly. I like the way that he puts it, which is that he says, and one of the, I mean, I heard him talk about conscious capitalism a couple of times, and he talked about how business has gotten away from and in some ways sort of forgotten about its higher purpose, you know, the role that it plays in a, and is supposed to play in a society. And it's not the only institution that has gotten away from its higher purpose. I think, frankly, media has gotten away from its higher purpose as well.
Yeah, probably a lot of our institutions could say as much.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that conscious capitalism is now is not only a book, it's a movement, an organization that definitely holds many of the same beliefs and values that the small giants do. And I keep running across actually other organizations that have similar. It all speaks of, I think, a need that's out there that lots and lots of people in the business world feel. They're looking for some meaning. They're looking for the higher purpose in what they do. You know, inevitably they wind up sort of contacting other people, and next thing you know, you've got an organization and a movement. There are actually quite a few. This is Social Venture Network. There's Evergreen Institute. There's the whole Great Place to Work group, which sort of works along the same lines. Right now it's pretty fragmented, but it may begin to consolidate as time goes along.
I've got to tell you, there are some businesses where all they tell you is we're going to do everything possible to be number one. And that's not connected to any kinds of values. And that to me is just so strange. It's like, well, really? I mean, would you kill people to be number one? Would you pillage and rape? I mean, Stalin was number one in Russia. That didn't go so well. So it's a disconnect to me when it's just about being number one, as if there's something inherently special about that.
Yeah. Obviously, if you say the goal is to be number one, the next question should be, well, how do you define number one? Is number one just that you're going to be the biggest? There are plenty of big companies that are not particularly good companies and that have had a deleterious effect on the people who work for them and, you know, the environment, what have you. And if that's your definition of number one, then why be number one?
Speaking of reasons to be number one, let's hear from our sponsor, the LA Film Prize. They've got a pretty good reason for you to be number one at their festival, $50,000 in cash for the winning short film. The executive director, Gregory Kallenberg, is here to tell us about some of the resources that the festival provides to help you get that film project made.
One of the things that has come out of the film prize that is absolutely incredible is this virtual community of independent filmmakers that are really focused on helping each other sort of complete their projects or realize their dream of doing a film. People convene on our Facebook page and through our Twitter and on our Instagram. And more often than not, they're asking each other for help. And to watch these projects come together through our social media channels or just through the contacts that they made during the festival is incredibly inspiring. I mean, it really shows the growth and the health of an independent film community growing out of this.
And unlike other film festivals, you all have an active part of that, right? You help connect people sometimes. If someone calls you up and says, hey, we're trying to find this person, you provide some assistance on that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have a phenomenal filmmaker liaison in Chris Lyon, and he can find you anything from an actor to a camera to the best po' boy in town. So, you know, again, I mean, when we are approached by filmmakers who are interested in making a film for the Louisiana Film Prize, we want to do whatever it is we can do to help them realize their dream and make it happen.
You know, there are a lot of different film festivals out there, but I can tell you most of them are not going to help you in that way. Try calling up the folks over at Tribeca or Sundance and saying, hey, I want you to help me make a film. They're probably not going to return your call. The LA Film Prize people will. It's a great opportunity to make a project that is meaningful to you and to your filmmaking team. Rough cuts are due on July 14th before midnight. Still plenty of time to get your film submitted. You can visit lafilmprize.com to learn more and use our special discount code NCVDs1 to get 50% off registration costs. Once again, lafilmprize.com, sign up with the code NCVDs1, like the number, and you're set to go with that. And now let's get back to our conversation with Bo Burlingham. In your most recent book, Finish Big, it seems to me a continuation of the ideas you talk about in Small Giants, how some of the people who get their deals, they maybe aren't finding the contentment they thought because they were just focused on the bottom line instead of other intangibles like how their people would be treated or other kinds of values. So how can people preserve their values even when they get to the point of sale?
Here's the thing. I got into this because, frankly, I didn't know much about it. For all the time that I've been at Inc. Magazine, which is 32 years now, we write very seldom about leaving your business. If you Google starting a business, you're going to get just tons and tons of stuff. And if you then Google exiting a business, you're going to get much, much less. And I realized that there was a hunger out there. When I went around and I did speeches about Small Giants, a lot of people would, sooner or later, somebody would raise their hand and say, well, you know, this is all great, but these businesses seem to be led by very charismatic people. What happens when they leave? And the truth is that for a lot of these companies, they hadn't really given much thought to that. In any case, I decided to go out and educate myself initially about what's involved. And I did that by interviewing dozens and dozens and dozens of people who had built businesses and then left them. And what I found was that about half of them were reasonably happy afterwards, and about half of them were totally miserable. And the difference between whether they were happy or miserable was not, had nothing to do, frankly, with the amount of money that they'd sold their companies for. And it had everything to do with other things. And so my book really is about, okay, what is the difference between the ones who at the end of the journey are happy, they can look back with pride on what they've done, they can feel good about what's happened to the other people who've been on the journey with them, and you know, who've moved on and are doing something else that engages them. What's the difference between those people and those who are sort of feeling lost and miserable? And, you know, I came up with basically seven factors, and which is sort of defines the structure of the book. But when I looked at the people who had trouble after they left their businesses, I realized there was sort of a common theme. And that was that they had all gotten something out of their business that they hadn't really been aware of until they didn't have it anymore. You know, it's easy to overlook the fact that when you run a business, you know, it's not just a way that you earn a living. It's your sense of identity. It's your purpose in life. It's the people, you know, your relationships with the people who you work with.
Or even your mojo, as you might say, from Small Giants, right?
Right. Well, yeah. It's basically that everything, all those things, which you may not appreciate while you own the business, once you leave the business, you run smack into them. I mean, people would tell me that the thing they feared the most after they'd sold their business was people asking them, what do you do? Well, they don't know how to respond to that, because really what people are asking them is, who are you? And that was a revelation in itself, because it said something to me about, okay, think about that. Think about what that means in terms of what business is. And when I looked at the people who had actually had good exits, the best exits, what I found was that they'd figured out how to recapture those things. But because they had money, they were actually able to do them on a higher level. The more I thought about this, the more I realized, you know, when we talk about a purpose, what do we mean? And really, what we mean is, for most of us, purpose comes from who we are serving. You know, and in business, if you at the very least have to be serving your customers, otherwise your business won't survive. Most people are also serving their families. A lot of people are serving their employees. A lot of people are serving their community. And that's, you know, business fundamentally is about service. And the reason that people lose their sense of purpose after leaving their business is because they no longer know who they're serving anymore. And the people who have good exits figure that out and come up with a way to bring purpose back to their life by serving other people. And, you know, naturally, for a lot of these business people, the thing that they know about after having spent their lives in business is they know a lot about business. And so they wind up serving other entrepreneurs, especially younger entrepreneurs who need advice and help. So that really did jibe a lot with the message of Small Giants, since Small Giants is really about, you know, when you get right down to it, it's about service as well. My idea of finishing big is finishing happy. It doesn't matter if you get $200 million for your business if you lose your sense of purpose and are lost and are miserable.
And it seems like that's the part of the deal that people don't think about. It's like the thing that we think about is the price tag, the number, and that might be notable maybe, what, a month or two, and then it probably fades and the other things that you're talking about become more pressing.
Yeah, I was talking to Norm Brodsky, you know, who I wrote Street Smarts with, and he sold his company for around $100 million. And I mean, that all didn't go to him. A bunch of it went to Uncle Sam, and then also some went to partners and other people. But he came away with certainly more money than he can spend in his lifetime, and what's left of it. And I said, but, you know, it must be thrilling to, after the sale, to sort of look at your assets, whether it's your bank account or your investment account, and see all those zeros. And he said, yeah, for a little while. After a while, it has no effect at all. And really, all these other factors come into play and are things that, you know, most people, even Norm, had to struggle with. He said he was very lucky that after he sold his company, he was still around and involved for a couple more years. And he said that was really, really important because it allowed him to sort of ease the transition after the business and, you know, start getting involved in new things, which for him meant sort of there are two sides to it. One is that he began spending about 30% of his time just doing sort of pro bono advice for mainly young entrepreneurs. He also started a number of businesses, some of which are doing quite well, and he's having the time of his life.
But it occurred to me when I was reading the book that the process is kind of inverted for people who are doing creative work. Sometimes musicians will go years without a contract, and then they finally get signed to the label. So while some business people are selling and moving to the next chapter for some, like actors who are getting signed or musicians, that sale is the start, but it seems like these things that you're describing still apply. So I was wondering if you'd have any suggestions for people who are approaching those kinds of creative contracts that can be really fulfilling or that can be really disheartening, as many musicians will be quick to tell you how much they do not like their label.
There are decisions that we all make. Now, artists, almost by definition, have a sense of purpose and an identity about who they are. For them, the problems, it seems to me, come up when they feel that for commercial reasons, they're forced to compromise it. I mean, why do they hate their labels? Well, is it that their labels, they feel their labels are taking advantage of them, they're forcing them to do things that they don't want to do? Ultimately, you have choices. And the artists have choices as well. I mean, if you go back to Small Giants, you've got Ani DiFranco, who, you know, is a singer-songwriter and was very successful in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, had lots of labels trying to sign her up. She was in great demand, and she decided she didn't want to work for that kind of a company, so she started her own label. And she's done very well with it. It's basically supported her and allowed her to live the kind of life that she wants to live. So the problem, I think, that artists sometimes get into is that they are naive about what it takes to make money. I think some artists are, in fact, resistant. While they need the money to survive, they feel that somewhat tainted.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think so many artists have that feeling about business sometimes?
I think it's because they don't understand business, because business has an image problem.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there is a big PR issue with business. I mean, it seems like a lot of the business people in popular culture are these corrupt, maniacal people. You don't see a lot of the types who are small giant leaders who are talking about how they're serving, or people like John Mackey who say, listen, business is about showing love and serving your community. You don't see those on the TV shows these days.
No, you don't. You're right. It's ironic, but there's a huge prejudice in Hollywood, which is a cutthroat industry, if ever there was one. I don't know if you've had any contact with it.
Oh, I'm aware. Yes.
Yeah. And, but it wasn't always that way. I mean, think of It's a Wonderful Life. It's a Wonderful Life was about a banker who came to understand what good he was doing and had done in his community. I wouldn't be the first to point out that Hollywood doesn't make or rarely makes those kinds of movies anymore.
Yeah, it's too bad. I mean, I would like to see more of those kinds of stories. So there are a number of creative types who listen to this show. This is your chance, Bo. Pitch them a story of the compassionate business person. Why should we tell more of those kinds of stories, and what would they look like?
Well, I think that, number one, you have to overcome the idea that there is something wrong with making money, or that there is something wrong, frankly, with capitalism. You know, if you go around the world and you see how poor people are pulling themselves up, the way they're doing it is with capitalism. The problems that they face are that the countries often in which they live are corrupt, and they do not allow people to pull themselves up. And to, as a result, most businesses in these countries, a lot of the entrepreneurial activities in these companies is frankly illegal. There's a great Latin American Peruvian author who has written a lot about this. And I just think that it's a case, you know, business is like any other human activity. It's got a lot of drama. It's got pathos. And, you know, the easy way, the cop-out way, is to is to portray the business person as the bad guy. And God knows there are certain business people who are bad guys. But then again, there are certain people in the culture, in the art world, who are bad guys too.
Yeah, you know, it's always ironic to me that guys like Michael Moore or Matt Damon, they're talented in their own ways, but they use the free market, they use capitalism to make a name for themselves. They're using advertising, they're depending on big companies to get their products out.
Well, Michael Moore is a number one hypocrite. And frankly, anybody who pays any attention to him ought to bear that in mind, that he is, in fact, exploiting them so that he can live the way that he lives.
The thing is, he goes on those 99, we are the 99%. It's like, listen, man, I think he falls in the, what, like 0.01%, not even the 1%. So, it is frustrating that high-profile people who are talented, I mean, I enjoy Matt Damon as an actor.
Yes, yeah, so do I.
It's just frustrating that he doesn't want to allow the systems, the free market that benefited him, to also allow others to find similar success.
Matt Damon grew up in Cambridge, he and Ben Affleck, Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I lived for many years. In fact, they both went to the same school that my children went to. And Cambridge, you know, like Berkeley, California, there's certain ways of thinking about things and looking at the world that are very deeply ingrained. And it takes a lot of courage to actually question them. You know, I think Matt Damon thinks that he's being courageous by standing up for the downtrodden. In fact, he's being cowardly in not challenging what is the common wisdom.
Yeah, a lot of the prevailing assumptions in our culture.
Right, right. I mean, he reveres Howard Zinn. Now, I knew Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn was personally a wonderful fellow, but he was a propagandist.
And that's another thing I think our culture struggles with. Someone can be an engaging person, very likable, but their ideas might actually be harmful. And so it's hard for us to separate those things, or to say, look, I really value this person professionally for what they do. That specific skill is quite meaningful, but the ideas aren't necessarily on par. I mean, just because someone is a success in one area doesn't mean his or her ideas are helpful, but we conflate the two sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, it's ironic. I actually wrote an article about this many, many years ago, but it's ironic that there was a time when to be a left winger in Hollywood required a lot of courage because you could lose your job. It is totally and completely turned around, where to be a conservative in Hollywood is you have to be courageous because you could lose your job.
Or some people just won't talk to you.
Yeah, yeah, right. It does require people to, you know, to think for themselves and everything. But I, you know, just to get back to the, in terms of the creative types, the basic thing is to question everything. You know, that has been the motto of rebels everywhere since time immemorial. And the thing that strikes me is, and what I would say to creative types is that whatever you hear from your friends, whatever you see in the culture about business, you should question it. I have to say that my views about all this have changed radically from when I was a wild-eyed radical leftist in my youth to today. And it's because I've gotten to see how business actually works and what is exactly involved in creating a company that is able to employ people, allow them to have to raise families.
To improve their quality of life a lot of times.
Improve their quality of life that in fact provides products and services that customers find so valuable that they're willing to pay a profit for them. To provide the tax base for our communities and to take responsibility for communities. I mean, these things happen. They happen every day and they happen all over this country. And the vast, vast majority of business people and entrepreneurs, what they want more than anything is to make a contribution, to make a difference, to leave the world a better place.
And that's an admirable aspiration.
Sure.
You know, I didn't know that about you, though, Bo. So you were a campus radical. You were protesting big business and burning their brochures or whatnot?
Well, I have to understand, I grew up in the 1960s.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that was a lot of campus protests back then.
Yeah, I was in the thick of that, and I got myself into a lot of trouble as a result. Really, I think the beginning of my own questioning happened when I got to a certain age when, you know, I had been a freelance writer for a while and, you know, freelance writing is sort of feast or famine, mainly famine. And I was married and I had two children and I realized that I needed to get a real job. And I about that time, I got recruited to go work for Fidelity Investments in Boston, where I lived.
That's a pretty dramatic shift from Campus Radical to Fidelity Investments.
Oh, it was. And I was aware of that. And I said, look, you don't want me. You know, I don't know the difference between a stock and a bond. And they said, oh, that's okay. We'll teach you that. We need somebody who can write. So I went to work there and I worked there for a year. And it was a very eye-opening experience to me because it wasn't anything like I imagined. I really just learned a tremendous amount. And it got to the point where I would like read articles in The Nation about the, which I subscribed to, about the financial services industry, which I was now a part of. And what they reminded me more than anything else were the FBI reports that the FBI used to do on me and my friends, where they got a lot of the facts right, but they had no idea how they all fit together. And, you know, after I'd been at Fidelity for a year, that's when I was actually recruited to go work for this new magazine in Boston called Inc. And that's how I wound up at Inc. And Inc., you know, was a really, my experience at Inc. forced me to think about and, you know, really challenged me to revise a lot of ideas that I had deeply believed at one point in my life.
Well, there you are. If it can happen for you, it can happen for anyone, right?
I guess. I don't know. It didn't happen to most of my friends, I must say. But
okay. Well, we are grateful that you decided to switch sides.
In a way, I don't feel like I've switched sides.
Okay. So you're still the zealous campus radical, but just retargeting your energies.
I still feel that the goal here is to create a good society. And I feel that for all its faults, capitalism, if it's done right, really has got a much better track record than any other system. And there's a lot that's wrong with it, but that's stuff that's possible to change. And really the important thing is to highlight for people the other possibilities. And, you know, that's tough because you're really going against what you were referring to earlier, namely this massive publicity machine that paints business as evil and businessmen as evil people. Some, you know, and I'm not Pollyannish about them. Some of them are evil, but
the ironic thing is they have to then go to business people to write the big checks to make those movies happen.
That's true.
All right. Well, let's go back to talking about a values-based culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think that takes a little more effort than having policies, right? Especially when it's a chaotic time or things are going fast and furious. How can people work towards values and not just, hey, do it like this. We've written out 30 pages, follow this precisely.
It's extraordinarily difficult, but the rewards are incredible. The personal rewards that a business owner or leader, CEO, gets from creating an environment in which people feel really sort of that they belong to something that is greater than themselves and they're contributing something positive to the world, where when you go to work every day, you have a higher purpose in your life. Creating that kind of an environment is difficult, but tremendously rewarding. The best company I know of, well, there are a couple, I shouldn't say that, but one of the ones that I've been watching very, very closely for 30 years is the what used to be called Springfield Remanufacturing Corporation. It's now called SRC Holdings. It's a remanufacturing business. Remanufacturing is essentially a big recycling operation of engine parts and things having to do with engines in Springfield, Missouri. And they've gone in the time that I've known them from a struggling spin-off of a big company that lost money in its first year to, you know, a more than $500 million company. And they've done it by teaching everybody in the business about business, you know, how to read financial statements, how to use those financial statements. And the result is they're made up of 13 or 14 different companies, many of which are run by people who started out as janitors or secretaries or customer service reps and are now general managers of these companies.
So giving everyone a certain amount of training to make the higher end decisions is a factor.
Well, the motto of their leader, whose name is Jack Stack, was to create a business of business people. Everybody's got to know sort of what's going on in the business and have some sort of say in it. Now, understand, they had 113 employees, many of whom barely had a high school education, but they went out to all these people on the shop floor and they said, look, you know, forget what you've heard about business. It's not that complicated. You don't need an MBA to understand it. Basically, what you have to understand is that business is essentially a game. And like any game, in order to play it, you have to get it. And in order to get it, there are three conditions that have to exist. Number one, you have to know what you have to know what the rules are. Number two, you have to get enough information so that you can follow the action and keep score. And number three, you've got to care about whether you win or lose. You need to have a stake in the outcome. And they set up the whole business around those principles. And they've been doing it after their first year. They lost $400,000. And they've never had an unprofitable quarter since then. And today, they're just an extremely successful employee-owned company and run by people who've sort of grown up in this system.
From my limited experience, it's easy to tell people, hey, do this and not that. And that works in the short term, but it's not so helpful in the long term when you run into situations that are not exactly this or that. And it's like, well, hey, I want you to get the essence of the values behind this and not just the yes and no. So do you have any other practical tips that you've seen from your own efforts?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of them, but let me just actually take what you just said and bring it down. What they were doing in this factory was remanufacturing heavy-duty engines for construction equipment and big rigs and that sort of thing. This is actually an old business, an old type of business. It goes back to Henry Ford sort of was in it. But what happens is that old worn-out engines come into the factory, and the people who work in the factory take them apart, and they have to make a decision. They go through all the parts, and they have to make a decision as to whether or not a part is okay, and if it's not okay, can it be fixed? And if it can't be fixed, then it has to be replaced with a new part. Whether or not you make money in that business depends on those decisions that are being made by people on the shop floor who are looking at these old, worn-out engines and deciding whether or not they can keep this part, whether they can fix this part, or whether they need a new engine. I mean, a new part to replace it. Because once the engines are done, they're sold with a 10-year warranty, and if those people on the floor have made bad decisions, the engines aren't going to work, there's going to be big warranty claims, the company will go out of business. So you're talking about people who have to make decisions. Now, either they're going to understand what the whole company is and why those decisions they're making every day are important to the success of the company. Or if they're being told what to do and they don't know why, and they haven't been told, look, this is the effect that your work is having and this is how it all works together, then that company is very likely going to get in trouble because people won't understand the import of their decisions. That is why this system that they developed at Springfield Remanufacturing has been so successful. Now, that applies to almost any business, that the key decisions that are going to be made that will determine whether or not you can stay in business or not are going to be made by people on the front lines doing the essential work that needs to be done for the business to be successful. And if those people don't understand what they're doing and why it matters, you know, what the overall effect, or if they don't care what the overall effect is, the business isn't going to succeed. And that's really the fundamental logic here. A business at its best is an organization where a whole bunch of people work together in order to create products and services that are good for customers, that customers are willing to pay them a profit in order to have them because they need them and because they value them. And, you know, either that is a bunch of people working together or it's a bunch of people who are just there to do the job and, you know, tell me what to do and I'll stop thinking. You know, that ultimately, in today's world, that doesn't work anymore.
All right, so let's look at it on the other side now. Let's say we have the people who are grounded in their values and they're going to investors. Let's say the people here are working on projects that aren't necessarily going to make money. So specifically, someone putting together a film or putting together a music album or a mural or whatnot. The reality is that the vast majority of films that get made don't even make their budget back. A lot of times these projects are getting made for a reason that says something like, well, this should exist. We want to raise awareness of this issue, or this mural could add some beauty to our city or something like that. So how would you suggest those types of people?
What you're doing is you're going to people and you're saying, please give me some money because this is a good project that's going to have good effects on our city or on people. It's going to be a worthwhile thing. That is asking for, not to put too fine on it, for charity, not an investment.
Well, I mean, couldn't you say that they are asking for an investment in value, that it wouldn't be something tangible, but that there was still value being exchanged?
Sure, and that's why people give to charity, right? I mean, I might give money knowing that I'm going to lose that money, but it's okay because I think that the money is going to be spent well and, you know, produce good results. But that's not an investment. That's a gift. That's a, you know, doing something for the public good and, you know, which is essentially philanthropy. And If that's what you're asking for is philanthropy, there's nothing wrong with that, but recognize it for what it is.
Okay. So are there no situations where you could imagine philanthropy also being a sort of investment?
Well, it becomes an investment when the expectation is you'll get a return on investment. If there's no return on investment, then it's not an investment anymore.
Right. But let's say the return is staggered. Let's say I'm going to put together this album with my band, in theory. I don't have a band. I'm just throwing a theoretical. Yeah. This album, we don't anticipate will get your money back, but we feel like in maybe 10 years, if we make enough of these, we can have a successful career, and then we'll be able to earn a living and pay back the people initially, perhaps.
Well, put yourself in the shoes of the person who you're asking for the money. Basically, that person says, okay, that's fine, but basically, when I give you this money, I'm not going to necessarily expect to ever get it back. And I may never get it back.
Sure, sure. Fair enough.
That's philanthropy.
Okay. So what would you say to people who are approaching people, you know, financially successful business people for that kind of philanthropy then?
Well, I think the whole pitch is different. If basically what you're doing is you're going to them and saying, look, I'm asking you to put some money in this project. It's not really an investment because, you know, I don't know if you're ever, the chances are you're never going to get paid back. But here's why you should do it anyway. You have to be realistic about it. I mean, if you go to them and you say, look, here's this project, there's a very good chance that you'll never see your money again. But really, this is an investment. You're not being honest. It's dishonest because what you're really asking them for is not what you're telling them you're asking for.
So be right up front. Just be clear and say, look, here's the reality.
You got to be truthful. You know, be up front about it. Just say, look, here's why I think you should do it. Now, that said, you need to decide whether or not you yourself are in business, right? And if you yourself are in business, then you have to make money on it. And how are you going to make money? You're going to make money because you're going to be doing such a service that people will pay you to get that service. Now, that's being in business. If you're doing it because you think you're going to make the world a more beautiful place by doing your mural or doing your record album, but in fact, whether or not anybody is willing to pay for it is not really important. The important thing is that you're going to be doing this. Okay, then you're asking for something else. You're not in business then.
Right. So be able to offer such excellence that it would be considered a valuable service on the free market.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the thing about a free market is that nobody's forcing anybody to do anything else. When you go out and you sell something, the buyer is, it's the classic cliche. It's a cliche, but it's a classic win-win situation where the person who's doing the selling is getting paid and the person who is doing the buying is getting something of value and is of such value to them that they're, you know, willing to pay you a profit in order to have it. Think about profit as applause, okay? Profit is the market applauding you for creating something that is of value to your customers.
That's a good analogy. From your Small Giants community, do you have any success stories, any developments either in business or from people who have thrived going through it?
Lots of them. One of the great companies that's in the Small Giants community, and it's a company that is a small giant. I've actually done some writing about them. It's called Nick's Pizza and Pub.
Yeah, that's a good name. Nick's Pizza, yeah.
That's right. The guy who runs it is Nick Cirillo.
All right.
And he started it. And he's a very idealistic young guy. And he started these, actually two Nick's Pizza and Pubs. And he really sort of viewed them as sort of a community center for people And he was constantly opening them up to raise money for people in the community, you know, somebody who had a child who was sick and didn't have the money to pay for the medical treatment. He would open up to raise money for them. And he would, you know, there would be some local cause. He would decide that all the profits one night would go to this local cause. And, you know, he's just doing all these things. And plus, he had great pizza.
There you go. It's always a plus.
Yeah, it was a plus. So anyway, he'd been doing this, and he had a great place to work. I mean, all his employees were like high school kids. And everybody complains about, you know, high school kids. Well, his high school kids were just terrific. And it was because he had his whole business set up in a way to really bring the best out of these kids. And these kids just thrived. So he was going along. The problem was there were certain parts of business that he was sort of naive about. And in particular, he was naive about, well, in financial terms, it was about the balance sheet, which is the where you look at your assets and liabilities. And he kept sort of getting loans and investments from people without really sort of understanding the long-term implications of this. And he got to a point where he got into trouble. You know, there were certain things that happened, and he wasn't able to make the payments that he owed on his debt. And it looked like he might be in a situation where he wasn't going to be able to make payroll, in which case he'd have to go out of business. And he didn't know what to do. I talked to him during this time, and I tried to get him some help. But the main thing was, the main help that people could give him was to educate him about why he was in such a terrible situation. And a lot of people thought that there was absolutely no way that he could possibly survive. And finally, I remember calling him up one day, and he said, "Well, I can see that we're going to run out of cash in 2 months, and that'll be it. We'll have to close." And he said, "I'm thinking of writing a letter, basically explaining the situation to my customers." And he said, "I hired a PR agency, and they told me this is a terrible thing to do, and I shouldn't do it." He was saying to me, he said, "I feel like I sort of owe it to my customers to let them know what's going on, because I've been very open with them always." And I said, and he said, "You know, there's no one to blame for this but me. I mean," he said, "I'm the one who made the mistakes, and it's too bad that the result of this mistakes is that we're going to have to close down. But I want to tell people what has to go on." So I told him my opinion, which was that he should ignore his PR agency and go ahead and do it, because what he wanted to do was the right thing to do. And, it, you know, he was doing it for all the right reason. So he wound up, I guess other people gave him similar advice. In any case, whatever, he decided that he was going to go ahead and put this out. Well, the word got out, and it went around the community like wildfire. And the community literally rallied to save these two restaurants.
Well, that's good. It's a nice, happy ending to that.
Yeah, it was. You know, it was really the community, which he had spent so much time supporting and doing so. There was like everybody in the community had a story to tell about something that the restaurant had done. Basically, the community saved the company. And also the employees did, too. I mean, the employees came to him and said, "Look, Nick, we'll work for free. We will want to keep this going." But in any event, they managed to get through it. And that, I could tell you lots of stories like that.
That was a good one. That's like a real life, It's a Wonderful Life kind of story.
It is. It is. Yes, it is.
All right. So last question for you. Let's say your ideal collaborator is listening to the show. What would you want him or her to know about getting the best out of Bo Burlingham?
Oh, to get the best out of me, it's hard to define what specifically it would be, but it has to do with my curiosity. What drives me is being able to understand something that I don't understand. I mean, when you look at Finish Big, for example, my new book, the thing that drove me through this was my realization that this was a subject nobody had really written about. And my book, there was nothing out there like the book that I was writing. And what's more, I was learning a tremendous amount as I went through it. And what I was learning wasn't just what does it take for a business owner to have a good exit, but it was really about what does the exit tell you about building a good business. And that was something that I am deeply interested by. So the best way to get the best out of me is to really pique my curiosity. And then you've got me.
There you are. Well, where can people go to learn more about you or some of the stuff you're working on?
Well, I do have a website, www.beauburlingham.com.
Okay.
That's probably the best place to go. And if I finally get it together to be a little bit more responsible about it, I'll even restart my blog there. So.
Okay, excellent. Thanks so much. And you have a nice day now.
Thank you, Nick. And thanks for what you do. I think it's really great. You know, I mean, I've sort of been watching you now for quite a few years, and I really am inspired by all the stuff you do.
Well, likewise, you know, I actually still think about the small giants ethic with the things right. I do. I mean, I have enough people now who want to do interviews with me where I could just do lots of them to get the numbers up. And it's like, yeah, but I mean, I don't want to do lots of them and do episodes of something that I just feel kind of mediocre about or that I don't have the time to really get into. It's things that I still think about from that book. So,
well, that's great. I'm glad to hear that, Nick.
All right. You take okay. care now.
Okay. Thanks, Nick. Bye-bye.
All right. So that was our interview with Beau Burlingham. A few things I want to touch upon from the interview. I had mentioned the book Conscious Capitalism, the one written by the Whole Foods CEO, John Mackey, in the discussion. Part of that is because the book does remind me a little bit of Small Giants, but also because Beau and John know each other, and I would say have influenced each other throughout the years. And no way of knowing for sure, but I would guess that a book like Small Giants encouraged John Mackey to come forward with his ideas. As Beau mentioned, it seems like the ideas he has in that book have been with him for a while. But I also suspect that Beau's book, Small Giants, made it more socially acceptable for business people to talk about intangible things. And that may have given John the courage to share in such an open-hearted way some of the things that he thinks about and the way that he sees love and service as a core part of business, and that business can be a powerful force for good, maybe the strongest power in the world. As you may have discovered, some business people don't enjoy talking about those kinds of things and prefer to focus on the bottom line. And so it does take some courage to come forth with a narrative that's a little different. It's something that we can all do for each other. When we are courageous and honest about the way we see things, might be a little different than the broad narrative that helps others do as much. I also found it quite useful to hear Beau's take on approaching investors for various creative endeavors. Now, Beau bristled a little bit at the term investors, because in those projects, it's often not very likely that the people providing the money will get their money back. So I was wondering if I was using the term in a broader way. I went and looked. You know, people still talk about getting film investors, and there's even the discussion about investing in our future, investing in our children. That's not always about a financial return, but I think it is helpful to hear Beau's take. When approaching an investor, he was saying, look, focus on the return that investor is getting. Now, in some cases, that return might not be financial. Maybe it's something else. The person putting up the money might not get his money back or her money back, but maybe she gets to enjoy a musical experience that will inspire her to build another business or to form a partnership. You hear so many stories where people say, hey, I met my partner, my boyfriend, my girlfriend, after seeing this film, after we went to this concert. It's a lifetime of connection made possible by some kind of work of art. You can't really put a price tag on that kind of relationship either, but it's a life-transforming kind of thing. As Bo was saying, though, honesty is key. It seems important to tell people right off the bat, look, there are risks. This might not be a financial investment, but you might be contributing your money to supporting something that you believe in. So it's a chance for you to expand your values, to see opportunities come to those who you care about. The reality is, making films or other similarly expensive creative endeavors, it's a costly thing. And most of the time, you can't bet on getting your money back. I mean, look, I was looking at statistics for Sundance, which is probably the most prestigious film festival in the world, certainly up there in the top five. Thousands of films get submitted there each year. Most don't get in. Of the films that do get in and get distribution, even those films don't generally get their money back from the distribution deals, all right? So very, very hard to get into Sundance, hard to get a distribution deal. Even then, for those people who are at the very top of their game, some of the best filmmakers in the world, even they are making films that don't tend to make their money back. So that's the reality. It's kind of discouraging sometimes to think about it just like that. But it is something that we need to address and be honest when trying to raise money for things. Bo was talking a little bit about the market. Well, the market will reward what's of value. Yes, but it's not a perfect assessor of value, at least not right away. Vincent van Gogh, one of the most esteemed painters throughout Western civilization, his paintings now sell for millions of dollars. In fact, he has several paintings on the list of most expensive paintings ever sold. In contrast, he sold only one painting during his lifetime. Quite a contrast. He died penniless, and he has this heartbreaking quote about his work. He said, "I can't change the fact that my paintings don't sell, but the time will come when people will recognize that they are worth more than the value of the paints used in the picture." Sad, isn't it, that Vincent van Gogh, the man whose paintings are now magnets and posters and wallpaper all over the world, that he felt that his life's work was not valued for anything more than the paints on it by most people. Those of us who care about art should want not just the creation of art, but ways that artists can see some kind of return for their efforts during their lifetime, so they don't have to be in that heartbreaking position where Van Gogh found himself. With someone like Van Gogh, the issue doesn't seem to be his lack of value, just the market's ability to perceive that value. He was doing something so new that people weren't ready for it. So that's a challenge. I was reading a post on Stephanie Palmer's webpage where she was talking about how David Simon pitched the show The Wire. Similar kind of thing. I mean, he was venturing into groundbreaking territory with that show. It was not like other shows out there, but he framed it in context of the police procedurals that came before and other groundbreaking shows that were different, but also trying to use genre to explore bigger issues. And that helped get the idea across to more hesitant, more apprehensive business types. I'll include a link in the show notes because it is a helpful thing to see. Basically, using the old as a way to make the decision makers more receptive to something new. In any case, as creative types, we should aim to form better, more meaningful relationships with the business leaders in our world if we want to make progress on our creative aspirations. And part of that means trying to understand what they're like beyond the cliches. To all you writers out there, I am so very tired of the maniacal businessman as villain. It's so predictable. In case you're wondering, this is what I associate that kind of thing with in a story.
I finally have Reading Railroad. All the railroads are now mine. I can charge whatever I want. First Monopoly and then the world.
Right. So if you don't want to come across like that, if you're trying to tell more complex, thoughtful stories about what the world is really like, maybe don't resort to that tired cliche. It's been done. Do something else. All right. Well, I'm exaggerating slightly to make a point. And, you know, an attempt at humor. Not all jokes are funny. All right. So it goes. You get the idea, though. You know, if anything, that kind of ruthless business type in a story reflects the kind of ruthless things that people in the entertainment industry do to be number one. There are some pretty ruthless people there, and I think maybe sometimes they're drawing on their own maniacal ruthlessness and painting that as the business other in the story. All right, let's not get all Carl Jung up in here. But anyway, there is that pressure out there to do whatever it takes to be number one. And as I said, that's just kind of crazy to me. I mean, again, Stalin was number one, Adolf Hitler, number one, all the magazines cover him, worldwide celebrity, biggest name ever, at least at the time. If someone really wants to be number one at any cost, to become a celebrity, no matter what it takes, what is to stop them from doing the horrible things that some of the worst people in history did? For me, being well known is not so awesome that I want to become a horrible person to get there. I'd rather live a life where I try to fight for values and a higher purpose. It's a challenging thing to do. I'm not perfect. I don't know if I'll get there. But a purpose-driven life where I make people's lives better somehow is the kind of life I'd like to live. Speaking of purpose, did you hear how many times Bo mentioned it in his conversation? It's a critical factor when we're trying to do something of value that's not just about the bottom line. Look, there are some bad businesses. As Bo said, they are a small percent of the business community, but they are out there. I have run into some business people who just want more, as much as possible, even when having so much has negative effects on others. It's just about bragging rights. That's kind of stupid, in my opinion. There was a documentary on Milton Friedman, and one of the execs that they were interviewing was talking about how he would expand his company so that he could own even a portion of the moon. He's not going to visit the moon. Why? So he could just say, well, no, I've got the moon in my portfolio. Ha ha ha. At a certain point, having more, getting those bragging rights, starts to harm those with whom the person is partnering. It might be that they're trying to negotiate a really unfair deal. Like, oh, sure, you get everything and I get peanut shells. Sure, sign me up for that. Or maybe it's just a matter of inconveniencing the fans who've been with you since the beginning. I mean, is it a God-given right to hear streaming music for free? No. No. And, you know, maybe quality notes get dropped during that strange technology of the streaming bits from the future. They should pay, you know, like $60 for the album to hear it in pristine form as intended by the record label, I mean, the artist. All right. So there are some examples where business isn't always fair, isn't always beneficial for everyone. But that doesn't mean that business itself, the framework, is a bad thing. Instead of condemning the whole system, why not try to nudge more people towards values-driven business like Bo tries to do? We mentioned Matt Damon earlier in the discussion. I want to come back to him. Matt Damon is a likable enough guy. I root for him. In the films, at least. A couple of his films, like Good Will Hunting, have been influential to me. So it's not like I completely loathe the guy, but I really wish he wouldn't make all those anti-business statements and support films that perpetuate that anti-business worldview. I mean, recently he did Elysium, which was basically a Marxist sci-fi fable about how society is really about the have and the have-nots, and how those in business are trying to screw the little guy. It should be noted that Matt Damon was well compensated for that film. I don't know how much exactly, but I don't imagine it was less than $1 million. He was made to look good by businesses throughout the world, many of them visual effects companies that struggle to make ends meet because the budget only allows so much money, and a lot of that goes to the big headliner stars. So if he really wants to make a strong anti-business statement, he could renounce his salary and give it entirely to the effects makeup, other departments that make him look good and live the movie style lifestyle that he does. Haven't seen that happen yet. For more on my thoughts on the trade-offs between paying the movie stars and the effects houses, give a listen to the interview I did with visual effects supervisor Mike Seymour. I'll include a link to that in the show notes as well. Anyway, Matt Damon is also doing a show for Sci-Fi called Incorporated. That deal just got approved recently. And it looks to be another TV show where one man is fighting this oppressive business system where they're all competing against each other and trying to hurt people. All right. Haven't seen that storyline before, Matt. Very surprising. Very original. Bravo, bravo. I don't begrudge Matt Damon the millions of dollars that he makes for his work. But a big reason he got there was because there were businesses that make high-end cameras, that make film, that make movie theaters, that make magazines, that make planes and cars, computer equipment, all the things needed to make a film production happen and to allow worldwide publicity. Because of all those companies earning a profit, he's been able to enjoy the luxurious lifestyle that he does. So why would he want to undercut the foundation that makes it possible? It's interesting that he likes to do these grand anti-corporate kind of things, and yet he's also a jet set kind of guy who will go abroad and shoot a commercial for, say, Nespresso. It was about 20 seconds. He got paid $3 million. A little bit of inconsistency there, don't you think? Now, I'm not saying this because I think Matt Damon is a bad guy. It seems like he does make efforts to make the world better. I just want him to be a little bit more thoughtful about how he does that. There was a piece that Fast Company did of him a few years ago, I believe, and they shot him in a way that made him look like a saint with the golden orange circle right behind him, talking about his outreach. Now, that's the thing. When he does his outreaches, it's about him being involved. The story is Matt Damon helps these poor people strive for better things. Now, think about how much sexier that is, at least for Matt Damon, than to say, hey, there's a system in place that allows people to serve others, to distinguish themselves, and to profit and make a living and better themselves that way. And that happens to be the very system in place that allowed Matt Damon to become the international celebrity he is. But that is just not as alluring as putting your face in front of the change that you're going to make, right? You get the glossy photo of yourself with the golden circle behind you. Look at how great Matt Damon is, as opposed to look at this system in place that's allowing people to better themselves throughout the world, even when benevolent celebrities aren't getting publicity for it. You see the difference? So, Matt Damon, if you're listening, I can't imagine why you would be, but you know, just in case, if you are, thank you for your movies. Thank you for inspiring us. Thank you for trying to do humanitarian outreaches. All those things are positive things, and I'm happy for your success. It's inspiring to see. But is it asking too much for you to say something nice about the system that made your success possible, specifically capitalism, and to let it stick around for a while so that others could, share the wealth, share in your success, and become successes as well by taking risks and offering something of value. I don't think that's asking too much, but maybe that's just me. Regardless, when we're striving to be great, not just by being big, but by being grounded in our values and in a guiding purpose, as Bo is suggesting, that gives us some guidance when these challenging situations come up. Again, the entertainment industry, very competitive, and sometimes people are well-intentioned, but they're getting pressured from their agent or publicist to go and do that more racy, more suggestive photo shoot, for example. And they say, well, you know, any attention is good attention. Well, if your primary goal is to get more attention, okay. If your goal is to build a career and develop relationships based on trust, I don't know. There are trade-offs. Does the girl in the skimpy outfit on the magazine shoot get my attention? Yeah, I'm a guy. I can't help noticing. Would that be the kind of girl I would be more inclined to have a long-term relationship with? Probably not. If she's willing to do that for attention, what will she do when things get a little tense with us? There are trade-offs and consequences for everything. Being as large as possible, getting as much attention as possible will get you noticed. But some of us care about things beyond that. And so it's worth considering as much when making decisions. Now, making decisions based on a values-driven outlook takes effort. It's not something that happens by default. We have to work at it. So maybe it didn't happen in the past, but it's always possible to course correct and start doing that now. Bo's books are as good of a way as any to start that. Specifically, I would say start with Small Giants. And then if you connect with that, maybe explore Finish Big. Bo also has the Small Giants community where you can learn from some of these business leaders like Bo and some of the people who run that group. Could be a chance to connect, to find inspiration from other business people who want to create businesses that are not just about the bottom line. And, you know, they have some really helpful free videos on there. I've watched a couple of them, much better than the typical introduction to business sort of thing. Some of the ideas in there were quite intriguing to me. And that's a free resource. You can go and check it out and find out if you want to get more involved. All right. So being an inspirational business leader takes effort, but it's worth trying to do. And connecting to those kinds of leaders, those kinds of business people, is valuable to us as creatives. I want to close by referencing two of the most creative and successful companies in our world today. Those would be Pixar and Apple. Both of them had the benefit of partnering with the business visionary Steve Jobs. From what I can tell, Steve could be prickly at times, but he was a values-driven guy. He cared about more than just the bottom line in his companies, and you can see that, I would argue, in their output. The movie Jobs with Ashton Kutcher and the biography by Walter Isaacson even make the case that Steve's rougher edges were softened a little bit as he tried to pursue business. In trying to make something great, he became a better person. Sadly, the film Jobs was mostly ignored, where critics preferred to turn their attention to The Wolf of Wall Street, which was more in keeping with that cultural assumption of the business person as all-devouring egomaniac. Not saying those types don't exist, but who would you rather have more of in our world? Wolf of Wall Street or visionaries like Steve Jobs? If you say the latter, maybe we can do our part to help encourage those types and try to make our own business endeavors more values driven. All right, well, that's our show. I hope you found it useful in some way. If you value the show and the way that we explore some of these more complex issues, would you take a moment to show support? Write us a comment on iTunes, give us a nice review, helps to get the word out. This is a different kind of show than most shows, so every little bit helps. I once did a book promotion with Boa where we got others to share the kinds of small giants they want to be. It was a chance to learn about some of my friends and colleagues in ways that I didn't know and just things about them that normally don't come up in conversation. So I would encourage you to take a look at that and maybe share some of your own stories about how you or your business is trying to be a small giant to your community. It would be great to hear about that and support your efforts. So mention as much in the comments. If you want to reach me personally, you can do so on the email. It's podcast@ncivitis.com. I want to say a special thank you to LA Film Prize for continuing to support our efforts here. Thanks again to Rob Coslow for the song True Gemini. All right. Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations.